In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Loving Father, we are grateful to gather this evening. We ask that you continue to bless us in our reflection on the Brothers Karamazov. Help us to be attentive to your will and open to your teachings. We ask this through Christ our Lord. Amen. So we cover two books in this section. The first essentially encompasses the Grand Inquisitor. Somebody was saying they took a whole class in the Grand Inquisitor. Was that you? Okay, that's incredible.
That was the jumping off.
Okay. Yeah, you could definitely see. Hopefully we can put some, help that to become a little bit more clear. And actually, probably after reading it or hearing about it, you'll probably want to go back and read it again. But that's okay. Okay, so to begin with, Alyosha and Lisa, that's the engagement that they're talking about. Chapter 1 of Book 5, right? There's not a whole lot to say on that, I don't think. Anything stand out? No? Okay. So then we get to Alyosha and Smirjakov, right? The encounter that they have, which is kind of an unusual encounter. You know, there's a lot... Smirjakov has a lot of self... hate, right? He says on page 203, I would have sanctioned their killing me before I was born, that I might not have to come into the world at all. That's a pretty awful thing to say about yourself, isn't it? But basically, we see that Smirjakov, it seems to be afraid of Dmitri, right? And really, anyway, regardless, Alyosha has gone to the house to meet with Dmitri, right? But he ends up going to the tavern, the metropolis, and that's where he meets his brother. The soup, and Ivan talks about how his thirst for life. And he says that at the age of 30, he's going to turn away from the cup. He's 23 now. He's going to turn away from the cup at 30. What does that mean, do you think? I think so. Yeah, it seems that's pretty obvious. Yeah. And if not that, then he's going to have to find some new meaning in life that he doesn't have. Okay. It's not clear, or is it clear? Does Ivan believe in God? Right. Maybe a deist, right?
Yeah.
I think so. Right.
Children and all of this.
I think that's exactly right. That is the key. Okay. So what we see here is that Ivan, does he believe in God? Maybe he believes in God. I don't think that's the point. He's wrestling with God. And that's the point, is that he can't accept the terms under which he understands that God exists. And the challenge that he has, that he is facing, is evil. It's the cross. It's the evil in the world. And so what he does, before we get into the Grand Inquisitor, we see rebellion. Who is the rebel? The title of that chapter 4 is Rebellion. Who is the rebel? It's Ivan. He doesn't accept. Remember, at the end of everything, he says, I don't accept God's version, right? I don't accept this version. So he says, I can't accept that harmony. This is on page 221. And it goes on to say, I renounce the higher harmony altogether. It's not worth the tears of that one tortured child who beat itself in the breast with its little fist and prayed in its stinking outhouse with its unexpiated tears to dear, kind God. So what he can't stand is the suffering. So he gives these horrible examples, needless to say, of suffering. And obviously, I mean, they seem to just get worse, right? One after the other.
He's talking about his idea of God. His idea of God seems almost like with the table, right? Which is that really isn't a God per se, the way that
sure,
and a different thing,
right? So, like, God is a divine watchmaker, perhaps, and mm-hmm. sets things in motion, but then steps back and isn't involved,
right? Yeah, there's no concept of God and a personal God or a God part of people's lives because God is just a creator.
I think that that's right. Yeah, right. Well, I will say this too, by the way. Dostoevsky when early in life, he was going to study engineering. Remember that? And it's after his mother, and he was sent away to study engineering in St. Petersburg. On his journey there, he has this observation, and it is a peasant beating an animal. And that has a really traumatic effect on him, on Dostoevsky as a young man, seeing this being done to this animal. And so there's actually, it's in this book, but it's also in The Idiot, I believe. I can't remember, to be honest with you. I've seen so many of his books, I can't remember, but I think it's The Idiot where he taught, or maybe it's Crime and Punishment, where he has this dream. Do you guys remember? Am I crazy, or is this, do you remember which one it is?
I thought we even had that.
Okay, maybe it's in this. It might be in this. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's later on then. Okay, I won't even go into that then right now. It's a dream about an animal that's gets beat to death. Oh, that's in this. Okay, yes. Oops. Yeah, so anyway. Okay.
It's interesting that he started the whole thing back. And what he says is, you know, I believe in God.
Well, it's the problem of evil. And so essentially, Ivan is articulating the problem of evil, which is probably one of the number one reasons why people turn away from God, at least the Christian version of God. They can't accept a world where suffering exists in the way in which it does. And, you know, it is a real challenge. I would say it's one of the reasons that a lot of people struggle with God. And actually, generally speaking, the more we experience that evil on a personal level, the harder that can be to contend with. So, yeah, I mean, it can really be difficult at times. So
I think people can understand evil, but like for a child to get cancer is different.
Innocence. It's the innocence. It's innocent suffering he's struggling with. So let's look at the Grand Inquisitor. 16th century, 1500, during the Inquisition. The Inquisitor is a cardinal, 90 years old, and essentially his goal in life is to root out heresy, right? And he does this by burning heretics. And what happens is that Jesus appears in Seville. This is all taking place in Seville, Spain. And Jesus raises this girl from the dead, right? She's in her casket. She raises her from the dead. And the Grand Inquisitor comes and arrests Jesus for doing this. And what ends up happening is this Grand Inquisitor starts lecturing Jesus and basically saying, you shouldn't have come back. We have everything in hand. We don't need you. And he uses as a skeletal framework, the temptations in the desert, right? Do you guys remember what the three temptations in the desert were?
Food, power.
Tempting of God, yeah. Actually, the three temptations correlate with the temptations in John. He speaks of lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life. So lust of the flesh is like, clear, right? I mean, it's just food. He uses the example of food, changing stones into bread, right? But any carnal desire is an example of that. Lust of the eyes is a little bit different, right? It's kind of like the ability to possess the world, right? And so the temptation is, I can make you the ruler of the world if you just bow down to me. And then pride of life, throw yourself down from this temple and angels will catch you. Resist God being in control. That may be a little bit harder to explicate, but pride of life is kind of saying, I want to do it my way, not God's way. It's kind of like the supreme example of disobedience, right? But anyway, they use these three temptations and basically says that Jesus answered them all in the wrong. And essentially, What do you think is the argument? Why? Why was that wrong? Yes, evil. It all goes back to that problem of evil. All of the temptations. Okay, so the problem, according to the Inquisitor, the cardinal, is that only a few will be saved according to Christ's law of freedom. But they're not just worried about the few who have the strength to be able to resist evil and all that, but they want to save all, to be all-encompassing, whatever that salvation looks like, right? I mean, they've got a very clear understanding of what that salvation looks like. It's not authentic freedom, right? And it's not authentic salvation. If anything, it's enslavement, right? It's anesthetization, you might say as well. I would say that what he is offering them is the basic satisfaction of the basic human desires. What the basic human desire that anybody has, the first thing is very clearly any carnal desire, satisfaction of all carnal desire. That's a base desire that everyone has, and it's a promise. It's a promise that in the 18th century, atheistic socialists would offer. They would propose that we can provide, we will satisfy all of a person's base desire. And if you simply satisfy their carnal desires, that will eliminate evil and it will eliminate crime. That's essentially the argument.
Class that I had in college.
Yes.
Basically, you get freedom, take care of it, you know, then you become a slave to it.
Yeah, and what you notice is something
not too different from what a lot of people want to do today.
It's the same thing that we've done since the beginning. Well, right. See, go back to the Garden of Eden. Right? Yeah. You can be like God.
That's correct. Very good. Absolutely. They're all definitely related. So this, on page 230, he says, "Behold, what thou didst further, and all again in the name of freedom. I tell thee that man is tormented by no greater anxiety than to find someone quickly to whom he can hand over the gift of freedom with which the ill-fated creature is born." We don't like freedom is what he's saying here. And the anxiety of freedom, the desire to get rid of that freedom, to surrender our freedom to some authority for the sake of what? Solidarity, unity, universal rule, right? So that's another thing that he points out as well. When I was talking, by the way, on page 229, he says, "There is no crime and therefore no sin. There's only hunger. Feed men and then ask them virtue." So it's kind of a false belief or an argument that if you simply provide for the physical needs of the human person, that will dissolve all sin. And that's definitely an argument 19th century. That's correct. That is right.
You better agree with that, or you're going to go to the gulag.
Correct.
Yeah.
So there's a desire for, let's see.
I have one other question to you on your thoughts on this, that in 1870, that's when basically in Vatican I, the declaration at that point.
Yeah.
And then you got this being written basically way 1870.
Yeah, this is post that, yeah.
Yeah, so you've got the schism that happened in 1054, and so then I just noticed if you felt also his reactions back to that Catholic Church then.
Maybe. I think there's an element of that. Maybe there is some element of that. But again, I don't know that Dostoevsky would have been, he's not like strongly anti-Catholic. He is anti-Jesuit, but he's not. But even there, it's not like all Jesuits that he would be against, but it would just be the ones that kind of have this like belief that they will somehow create this new world order here on Earth. I think and I think one of the things that Dostoevsky saw in his travels in Western Europe is that they had Jesuits who would be teaching, but had really no belief in God at all. They were Jesuits. They were priests, but they didn't believe in God. And it was like, that was a scandal to him. You have a priest who's teaching, and the Jesuits had a lot of power at that time, right? They were in some ways kind of like soldiers of the Pope. So that there was a little bit of a threatening thing there that was also scandalous for him. What about the three powers? What are the three powers? Those forces are a miracle, mystery, and authority, right? Do these correspond with the temptations? I think that they do, right? So The miracle, I guess, is changing bread into wine, right? The mystery is pride of life. Cast thyself down from this temple. The authority, of course, is the authority of Satan, right, in the world.
The devil is in terms of, well, he's testing his faith. Said something about, well, if you just put yourself up the parapet, ask an angel to save you. So
he says, this is what he says on page 233. We're not working with thee, but with him. That is our mystery. We're not working with you, Jesus. We are working with him, Satan. That's the mystery. That's the clear thing is articulated here. He says it's long, eight centuries since we have been on his side and not on thine. Just 8 centuries ago, we took from him what thou didst reject with scorn. That last gift he offered thee, showing thee all the kingdoms of the earth. So they took the kingdoms of the earth, right? We took from him Rome and the sword of Caesar and proclaimed ourselves sole rulers of the earth. Thou here too, hitherto, we have not been able to complete our work.
So what's the 8th century?
That's a great question.
That's when Charlemagne was crowned head, Charles the Great of the that's kind of when that's that same time frame.
I don't know if it's the fall of Rome or whatever, if it correlates with the fall of Rome and essentially the Roman Empire becomes the Roman Church. I mean, I don't know. That's a good question. I do know, just going on here, one of the things that he talks about is the third craving is universal unity. So for the craving for universal unity is the third and last anguish of men. What does that mean? Yeah.
I think it has to be coupled with
the universe. That's right. That's exactly what is said here, too. It says Caesar's thou wouldst have founded the universal state and have given universal peace. We've taken the sword of Caesar, and in taking it, of course, have rejected thee and followed him. I think, yeah, go ahead.
So it's just, they're following, I mean, we try to follow like a twisted version of universal, like unity and peace. It's like, that's the only God can give us.
It's what we truly desire, right?
Yeah.
It's the tower. Isn't that the whole point of the Tower of Babel? That we will attain heaven on our own without God's help. We'll build this tower to get to heaven, and we'll do it without God's help. That's kind of what universal unity is. Peace, clearly, in this case, without God. It's the desire to attain peace. The great conquerors, Timurs and Genghis Khan, whirled like hurricanes over the face of the earth, striving to subdue its people. They, too, were but the unconscious expression of that same craving for universal unity. We saw that in World War II, right? With Hitler. What did he want? He wanted a kingdom of unity over the entire world. Arguably, you know, is that not also, to a certain extent, what Napoleon wanted, a universal kingdom? Isn't that what he wanted, right?
And putting himself in the place of God.
Okay.
Power comes from giving them bread.
That's exactly right. So they give them bread, provide for their carnal desires, and they will surrender their freedom to authority for the sake of attaining the illusion of universal peace, universal unity. And then what's the secret? 237. Yes, exactly right. That they don't believe in God. That they created this myth. There is no real God.
Well, there wouldn't be no real God if someone in a state authority can't superimpose themselves in place of God. You don't need this God because you have me. We've seen that several times in history.
Right. That's right. So what can we say about this in general? As it relates to what Dostoevsky thought as the principal struggle of the day. He saw that the principal struggle of the day was against materialism, right? Remember, we talked about this at the beginning. So what are the isms that Dostoevsky feels like he has to combat? And this is, he's presenting the Grand Inquisitor as the ultimate illustration of those ideologies. that must be combated against. So one is materialism. What did we mean by materialism? It's a definition of the human person as purely material, no spiritual aspect of themselves. And that if you simply fulfill the material aspect of the human person, their carnal desires, give them bread, then they will be happy. And you will resolve all illusion of crime and all illusion of sin. So materialism. The second is socialism. And for him, socialism is rooted very much in that materialism, right? But it has a little bit more of a tinge of universal unity as well, right? Every single human person is equal, right? Their needs are equal. Provide for those needs in an equal way. And then atheism. There is no God. Oddly, this involves, in some ways, has an overarching authoritarianism, right? Although Dostoevsky wouldn't be able to articulate that, but it's an understanding that, as far as government is concerned, that any attempt to implement this, which ironically the Russian Revolution becomes an instantiation of that attempt to instigate this reality, right, necessitates a dictatorship. It was called by the Bolsheviks of the proletariat, right? And so, in other words, we will implement a temporary dictatorship in order to establish this socialism across the world.
70 years later.
Exactly. 70 years later, the dictatorship remained. Anyway, he had at least an intuition that that would be the case. I don't know. I don't think it's that complicated what he's saying here, especially if you had read his notes from the underground, then it becomes, to me, that's his philosophical work. But
I think you could see that false utopianism. You know, the fact is,
correct,
you're going to give up your freedom, but you're not going to get any of the things that I'm promising you. You're just going to lose your freedom.
That's an irony of materialism, is the belief that the irony of materialism as a philosophical theory essentially argues that there is no such thing as freedom. They both argue that there is freedom and there isn't freedom, right? So there's a materialistic determinism, in other words. In other words, another way of putting it is to say that our materialistic circumstances so determine who we are that there really is no freedom, and freedom is just an illusion. And yet at the same time, if that's the case, then why do we even make any arguments whatsoever about anything ever anyway? So it does center on this question of freedom and the meaning of freedom, I think. Okay, that was very deep, right? Any questions or thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do.
No, he definitely had a position. So with Dostoevsky, you have to realize that he, early in life, felt himself to be like a socialist reformer. And then and when he wrote his first book, his first popular book, that kind of was, it's called Poor Folk. It was like, it's an epistolary text. In other words, it's a text that is basically a compilation of different love letters between these two lovers. But it basically was an illustration of the socioeconomic conditions of the time, and it was seen as genius the way it was done, and it catapulted him into fame. And he felt very strongly that socialism was the answer to the problems of the day. What were the problems of the day? They had a czar. It was an authoritarianism. In addition to that, there was peasantry, right? Essentially, it was a serfdom. It was a form of slavery. So he saw socialism as the answer. And he entangled himself in this anti-czar group that was essentially organizing to assassinate the czar. But they got caught. And he got caught and arrested as well. And he was tried and he was convicted and even sentenced to death, remember? And it was his experience in the prison system living in Omsk for 4 years, where he really had to go deeper within himself, and he experienced this conversion, a conversion in terms of turning back to his Christian faith, for one, but then also realizing that the idealism of the socialist was not going to work. He experienced this and knew this from his experience in prison, because he was essentially, he was poor, yes. Dostoevsky was poor, but he was also noble. He was part of the nobility, right? He wasn't a serf. And nobody could have been treated worse in prison than somebody like that, because they were despised by the other prisoners, right? And there was no sense of fraternity between him as a noble and the other serfs. And there is a point in this basically autobiographical account, Notes from the House of the Dead is what it's called. And it's essentially, once again, it's a text that has never really been written before. After he gets out of the prison, he writes Notes from the House of the Dead. And it's very autobiographical in some ways, but essentially he highlights the point that there really is no fraternity between the serfs and the nobles. And that's just an illusion. So the young intellectuals who believe that there is some common ambition on the part of the serfs and the intelligentsia, that's an illusion that doesn't exist. And he only discovers that after he's been in prison for 4 years, and he finds no common ground between the two of them. There's no sense in which they feel anything common with them, right? The serfs don't feel like they have anything in common with him. And there's a point in that book, Notes from the House of the Dead, when the main character, which is essentially Dostoevsky, joins the serfs in their protest about the quality of the food. They literally look at him and say, "Why are you standing here with us? You're not one of us." They have no ability whatsoever to understand why he is standing there with them. There's no sense of fraternal unity at all. It's a complete mystery to them. And it's that realization that there's no commonality between the intelligentsia and the serfs. So the belief of the intelligentsia is that if you simply hand the power over to the serfs in some way, they will rise up together and overcome the Tsar, right? And overcome the authority. And Dostoevsky realizes from his experience in prison that that's an illusion. They don't have a common belief. They don't have a common desire. So you give them that authority, that power, they won't know what to do with it, is what he's saying. Now, why were we talking about that? Now I've gotten off a little bit. And what were we? Oh!
Yeah, what was Dostoevsky's?
So that's the change for him. Sorry. That's the change in him.
All of the isms require a dictator, a father figure, a daddy mm-hmm. to work.
Right.
And all of the isms will ultimately, and the populace, the authority too, in exchange for personal freedoms and what I really think, if you toe the party line, you're golden, and the daddy or the leader will take care of you.
Yeah.
And the way to create a homogenous society where everyone agrees with everyone, just take out the ones that disagree with you.
That's correct.
That was the example of disagreeing.
It's all twisted versions of the truth. It's like we're God, you know, we're supposed to surrender to God in a way. It's not giving up our freedom, but it's like working with him in freedom, and he takes care of us. But all of these other isms are just twisted copies of that.
Because remember, Jesus said, "I'm the way, the truth, and the state finds the truth."
Right. And so the ending of this particular passage, remember that the Grand Inquisitor is asking for a response, wants a response. And the only response he gets is a kiss from Jesus. Course, his response is, he decides not to execute him, but he lets him go and says, never come back. And so then obviously, like at the end of the book, Alyosha, he kisses Ivan, right? So that's kind of like a recapitulation. Yeah, it parallels it. Yeah. And it's a recapitulation of what was said by Jesus, right? Yep. Okay. Then in the next chapter, we actually have a continuation of the narrative. So we kind of, Ivan, he's very intuitive, isn't he? I don't know if you've read on in the book, we see that he's very intuitive. And for some reason, he has this feeling of angst within himself as he's going back to his father's house. And he can't figure out at first exactly what it is. And then suddenly he realizes that it's about Smerdyakov. He cannot stand Smerdyakov. He's just intensely angry with him. So he says Smerdyakov was on his mind and that it was this man that his soul loathed. Why did he hate this guy? This despising of him.
I thought there was some secret between his father.
St. Augustine says, if there's something that you don't like in another person, remove it from yourself and it won't bother you as much. I think that one of the reasons Ivan cannot stand Smerdyakov is because they're so much alike. And part of it is, yeah, Smerdyakov acts like he's got this secret that the two of them have between each other. And at the very least, Smerdyakov is poorly representing. He's not being truthful, right? That's the very least. Because what does he talk about? He's like, well, it's like, I might just have a fit tomorrow and fall down the stairs. And okay, so you might have a fit. And you should go to Chermoshnya, right? And then he talks about Grigory and Marfa, the medicine that they're going to drink. They're going to be out, right? Mentally incapacitated, drugged. So he's kind of setting up this situation that's like, what the heck? Something bad could happen, right? Nobody's going to be aware of it. So it is a foreshadowing. It's a movement of the plot, so to speak, right?
I think he knows that that's his half-brother.
That's a great question. I think so. I think that also irritates him, yes. I think that irritates Ivan, that Smerdyakov has too much familiarity with him. He's supposed to be the valet. He's supposed to be the soup maker. And yet he really is treating Ivan like he's an equal. And that's irritating him.
Well, nobody likes it when a peasant thinks they're the same as you.
Yeah, yeah. So Ivan does something really strange, doesn't he? At night. What does he do? He goes downstairs and he sits on the steps and he listens for his father. He doesn't really seem to know why he did that. He did it twice, but he does this. Sure, for sure, for sure. Anyway, he does that, which is kind of a strange thing, but he's upset at himself for that too, though. Like there's a lot of self-resentment for what he did there. I don't really understand fully why what is that about, do you think?
I think it's almost like a confirmation.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
I mean, the signals were explained too. Gave the signal up to Dimitri. He's wanting to know if she comes by, if she's going to be knocking on the door.
Sure. I don't know. It's just kind of interesting that he remembers this years later and he resents his behavior. Like he didn't like how he behaved. It was like he was spying on him. Ivan was spying on Fyodor Pavlovich, his father. Yeah.
Protecting, and he was kind of worried that something was going to happen, you know.
I think you're right.
And all that stuff, like somebody was gonna
sure
Dimitri, yeah. Dimitri attacking,
could be. I think you're right about that, yeah.
And then him knowing that, giving up the signals, then
exactly,
Dimitri, which we
can't
know.
That's all about, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's setting up,
of course, it is. Like I said, it's moving the plot,
laying it out for what comes.
Well, anyway, his father wants him to go to Gorskin, to Chermoshnya, to visit with this guy named Gorskin to see if he can get this cops, right? And he can tell if he's lying or if he's telling the truth by looking at the beard. If he strokes his beard, his left hand and grins, he's trying to cheat you. But if his beard is just shaking, then he's telling the truth. He only trusts Yvonne to do this. He doesn't trust Alyosha. He doesn't trust the priest. He just trusts Yvonne to be able to do this. Yvonne decides that he's not going to do that, right? And what happens with Smirjakov? He did. He has his fit. He allegedly has his fit. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Maybe I'm giving away too much. Well, let's transition to looking at book six, the Russian monk, Father Zosima. We should note this, page 258. A grain of wheat, except the corn of wheat fall into the ground and then die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. I've been to Dostoevsky's tomb, and that passage is on his tombstone. So
where's his tomb?
It's in St. Petersburg. In St. Petersburg, Russia, yeah. So, unless a grain of wheat fall to the ground and dies, it remains but a grain of wheat. But if it dies, it brings forth much fruit. This is a quote from sacred scripture that's made several times in this book. And for us, Father Zosima is an example of that grain of wheat that dies, right, to self, and then bears much fruit. So, we, of course, hear a little bit about the early life of Father Zosima, right? And his love for the church. And we even hear about his brother. He has a strange brother who essentially gets tuberculosis of the brain and becomes kind of a religious fanatic. He transitions from being an atheist to being this religious fanatic. But it's very influential on Zosima. In some ways, Father Zosima follows a similar life to Dostoevsky. He ends up getting sent away to a military academy, right? And he never sees his mother again. So there's some parallel there. But Father Zosima does not become a good person at first. He actually lives a life of dissipation, right? And even gets himself into trouble by challenging a girl that he had been seeing, her new husband, to a duel. And the night before this duel, he beats his servant, Afanasy. And then suddenly he has this like conversion within himself because he remembers what his brother said about the servants. Why is it that the servants should always be serving us? Maybe we ought to serve the servants. So he has this conversion. And after this conversion, he feels like he can't kill this guy and take this girl, her husband, away from her. So, of course, he also can't not fight. So he gives him the first shot. He gets shot in the face, right? And then he throws the gun away and refuses to shoot. So it's a radical conversion, kind of like St. Paul. After this, he dishonors his unit a little bit, but then he decides he's going to become a priest, a monk. He wants to be a monk.
Bizarre structure that we wouldn't take anybody off the street. I mean, you know.
No, but I think that the call, it's a call. It's a vocation. So if one is called, then one is called. And so I think that it's the fact that he felt that call.
Okay. But almost every religious person we've come across in this book so far, that's a really horrible backstory.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah, of course. They're not. Actually, if anything, Alyosha is the one exception, isn't he? Yeah. So for Father Zosima, after this experience, he has this strange visitor, right? It starts visiting him. I love that. This to me is just gold. The whole thing I love. And it's pure Dostoevsky. I'm going to tell you right now, this is pure Dostoevsky. This guy comes to him and he confesses that he murdered his wife, right?
No.
A girl he liked, engaged. Right?
Yeah.
He murdered this person, this woman that he had an infatuation with. And not only did he do that, but he made it look like the servant had killed her, and he'd gotten away with it
for 14
years. And at this point, he thought, well, I'll get married myself. I'll have children. The more he tried to live a life of integrity, the more he felt convicted of the wrong that he had done and the need to confess what he had done to the world. So remember what I said about Dostoevsky in every character. They have both the capacity for great good, the capacity for great evil. So remember Victor Hugo's book, Les Misérables, right? Who is the character that Jean Valjean, he had been a criminal. He robs from the bishop and the bishop allows him to take the silver and he changes his life, becomes a completely different person, but there's still something incongruous about how he has lived his life, right? He's still Jean Valjean. Somebody gets arrested in his place and is being accused of being Jean Valjean, right? He can never escape his past. There's a dynamism there, right? So I love Victor Hugo's. He's a great author. Okay, he's a great author too, by the way. I mean, I don't think he didn't himself personally believe in God, as I understand, but I mean, he got it. I mean, he understood the human condition and the human persons. Dostoevsky, every human person has a capacity for great good and great evil at the same time. Okay? So nothing, I can think of nothing that illustrates this better than the day before he is going to confess, he comes back to visit with Zossima. He says, remember this moment. I love it. You know, I mean, here he is on the cusp of confessing his wrongdoing, conversion, and change, and he has the capacity still within him to murder. That's Dostoevsky.
He was afraid he would turn him in, but he was afraid that if he didn't confess, he would be, somebody would know that he was a coward. Like,
it's, he was a criminal.
Yeah.
And, no, not that he, no, that he didn't go forward with.
If he didn't go forward.
Yeah.
Well, Alyosha knew.
I love it. I mean, it's just amazing. He says, I came to kill you. That's what he says.
And he never felt bad about murdering the woman. He felt bad that somebody else went to jail.
Well, that person never actually went to jail.
Well, he did.
But he never got convicted. He died before he was convicted.
He felt worse about him than the girl.
Yeah. Anyway, he confessed. And then, of course, like everyone who does something incredibly reactionary, he dies of brain fever. Well, he died of something. I don't know that it was quite brain fever, but he got sick and then he died. To me, that's pure Dostoevsky. In Crime and Punishment, one of the evilest characters is, my brain is just not working well, Svidrigaïlov. What a name, right? Remember the character Svidrigaïlov in Crime and Punishment? So he attempts to rape Dunya. And then, of course, she resists and he doesn't do it. Afterwards, he decides he's going to give everything away, which he does in a profound act of charity. He gives all of his money away, right? And then he goes and kills himself. So it's just like the capacity for great evil and the capacity for great good side by side and together. That's Dostoevsky. And I think it's also the human person, to be honest with you. I mean, that's human nature. So that's where I would say, they say that in some ways, Dostoevsky is the father of psychology. He has the ability to understand the human person and describe the human person with incredible clarity.
Can you imagine when he was before the firing squad?
Yeah, right.
Can you imagine?
No.
Other people got shot. Now it's his turn to reloading the musket.
I agree.
To reprieve.
Yeah.
Alone, I dropped dead.
Apparently that was a common thing, though. So I don't know. Anyway, kind of what follows after this wonderful story, remember that he has this encounter with Afanasy, his servant, later in life, right? And he gives him, what is it, half a ruble or something? But I thought that was kind of interesting. And then essentially what follows is a collection of maybe wisdom literature, right? So Actually, to be honest with you, as I've listened to or read through this, I listen to what he says about like living a simple life as a priest, right? Just teach the Bible. All you have to do is share it. To me, that there's something beautiful about that and true, you know, just share the Bible with people. Take one day a week, or not just one day, but 1 hour a week, share the Bible. That always strikes me as like, wow. That's so true. Anything stand out?
I thought it was the definition of hell.
Yeah. Isn't that right? Mm-hmm. Gosh, that's a good definition.
Well, and that's kind of like with C.S. Lewis, you know, the book Mere Christianity, that the gates of hell are actually locked on the inside. Kept there, they choose to be there.
Yeah.
And that's when we see her Satan basically rejects God.
I also thought it was nice that at the beginning, he says, I can't remember who the other guy is, he said, but I sense that you think I like Alyosha better than you.
Yeah.
And it's just that he reminds me of the brother. So I thought that was really nice if he knew he was dying, not to mess with his head. Why am I not worthy, or what did I do wrong? Like, he cleared that up.
Yeah. He says, love a man even in his sin. For that is the semblance of divine love. Is the highest love on earth. Love the animals. Why love the animals? Because they're without sin. Only humans sin. Make yourself responsible for all men's sins. That is the truth, you know. Friends, for as soon as you decide you sincerely make yourself responsible for everything and for all men, you will see at once that it really is so. There's a sense of solidarity there, right?
So I didn't really get that. I mean, I didn't buy into that until I didn't really quite grasp what he was trying to say. And then later on, he says, remember, particularly, you cannot be a judge of anyone. No one can judge a criminal. I said, he is such a and that perhaps he may have done something.
That's right.
You know what I'm going to do.
I also think that remember this about Dostoevsky. If Dostoevsky says that every human person has a capacity for both great good and great evil, just because you are the one who's done great good doesn't mean it wasn't within your capacity to do great evil as well.
I think the point there is you may have done it.
You may have contributed, yeah. Right. And there is a real sense of solidarity that he values, right? Yeah. Seek suffering for yourself as though you were yourself guilty of that wrong. Accept that suffering and bear it, and your heart will find comfort, and you will understand that you too are guilty. How often do we look for suffering? We look to avoid it most often, right? But then there's another thing here, and this is also common among Dostoevsky's writings. Kiss the earth. Love it. If you remember the character in Crime and Punishment, I apologize to all these different names. He, before he confesses to the police, he bows down in the square in St. Petersburg and he kisses the ground, essentially makes this open confession before God of Earth, so to speak. Yeah, so I mean, that's not just something. The connection between earth and God, between nature and God, between nature and humanity, it's there, right? So I think he highlights that by kiss the earth, okay? And then again, he says that too, like at the end, you know? Praying and kissing the ground, quietly and joyfully gave up his soul to God. And then we're set up for next time because something incredible happens. Unexpected, so strange, upsetting, bewildering in its effect on the monks and the townspeople, that after all these years, that day of general suspense is still vividly remembered in the town. You've read on, you already know what it is. Yeah. Any thoughts?
We see this struggle between evil. Does he ever conjecture about some people seem to be some like Alyosha's?
It does seem that
basic.
Yeah, like the Karamazov nature, sensuality, the inclination to sensuality. I mean, Smirjakov is as much a Karamazov as any of them, right? As Ivan, So, I mean, we have to include him among the brothers, Karamazov. Mm-hmm. So Smerdyakov, yeah, he's an illegitimate son, but he's still a brother by nature to Ivan, Dmitri, Alyosha. So nature seems to be part of it. And human nature, I suppose. The Karamazov nature that is something that is inescapable. You could, you know, Alyosha, oh, he's still a Karamazov. He still has that Karamazov nature within himself. What is that Karamazov nature?
But some people seem to have more restraint. And what causes that?
Well, I don't know, but Dostoevsky did not have restraint. He had anything but restraint as a person. So I don't think he certainly was not that person. I mean, he struggled with alcoholism. He struggled with gambling addiction. He was a chain smoker. I mean, he was anything but a person of restraint, for sure, in his own life. Even infidelity at times. So he was anything but a person of restraint himself. I guess, I mean, I'm just trying to think. I don't know if he thought within himself that, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
So in the Bible, and it talks about like the sons suffer for the sins of the father.
Yeah.
Like, so that would kind of be like the nature then of
your
family, how you were raised. So you're not really cursed, like in the Bible, I think it used the word curse.
Yeah.
To the, but it's kind of your family nature then.
If there is a theme in this book, I think the theme is that scripture passage about a grain of wheat dying. Unless a grain of wheat dies to itself, it cannot bear fruit, but it remains just a grain of wheat. So I think the interpretive key is the one who gives himself over to God, because it's not about human nature. Nothing in human nature is salvific. It's give yourself, die to self, and give yourself over to Christ and allow Christ to live through you. That's the key to happiness. That's the key to living that so-called act of charity that is the key to authentic happiness as well. That's precisely what the damned person is incapable of and does not do, right? Look at that discussion about hell. The person in hell cannot love, right? The suffering of being unable to love, even after they realize that that's their only source of happiness, they're not able to do it, because if they didn't do it in life, they can't do it again. They can't do it after they've died. And he believes that there are those, who are truly just maliciously there, right? For such hell is voluntary and ever-consuming. They are tortured by their own choice, for they have cursed themselves, cursing God and life. They live upon their vindictive pride like a starving man in the desert, sucking blood out of his own body. But they are never satisfied, and they refuse forgiveness. They curse God who calls them. They cannot behold the living God without hatred, and they cry out that the God of life should be annihilated, and that God should destroy himself and his own creation. And they will burn in the fire of their own wrath forever and yearn for death and annihilation, but they will not attain to death. So Eastern Orthodoxy, some tenets of Eastern Orthodoxy believe that there is universal salvation for all, even after death. In other words, the hell of the damned is a temporary hell. There is a belief in that. But this seems to be suggesting that, at least for some, that's not the case. It's not temporary. They've truly maliciously chosen this, and this is what they want, and this is what they'll always want.
God ultimately gives you what you want. And
yeah.
If you reject him, then it becomes hell, because you realize that it's a lesser good, which is really what Satan did and all the angels that fell. And ultimately, their choice was a lesser good, God's good. Frank Sinatra's kind of wrong, right? Because he did it. I did it my way.
Agree.
Ultimately, agree. And then you go to hell if you do that.
That's right. Yeah, that's very well said. Yeah. Okay. Well, good. So our next class is going to be on December 6th, I think. No, 4th.
Yeah.
It's a Thursday night. It's the first Thursday. So I apologize for not having much time. I mean, it was a challenge for me too, though, I got to tell you. Being in Rome, I was listening to this in Milan. I had a day in Milan where I was reading this. So I got back on Monday, yeah. So I was working on this then. Probably when we're in New Zealand, I'll be doing the same in January, because when we get back, it'll be...
We appreciate your effort.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I know it's a lot for you guys, too. I mean, this is a lot of work. I'm afraid I'm going to have to.
What would you be thinking it would be?
What that?
Would it be 7 and 8?
Oh, yeah. For next time?
Yeah.
Yes, book 7 and 8.
Thank you. I actually love it, though. I mean, I got to admit, I mean, I do love this book so much. And it's just like, it's such a pleasure to read it, really. So it's not hard for me. I don't know if it is for you guys, but it's not for me.
Okay, I have a question. Probably you're just going to go. But throughout this, these chapters, you know, there's so much. Like, is this a euphemism for something?
Laughing?
Yes. I mean, the first assignment, you know, half the time you turn around and there's this long speech, and then he goes, I was laughing. I really meant to.
Like Lisa?
And yeah. And then here, you know, when he, after his conversion and everything, well, they were laughing. All the townspeople were laughing. They were, and this, so it's a different kind.
Yeah.
What is this? Is this like some symbolic?
They thought he was crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, the person, okay, so in Russia, I understand this culturally about Russians. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that you don't smile. And then if you smile in Russian, they think you're simple. You're stupid. So, yeah. So I'm just saying that's what they think. I don't know if that... Well, I mean, that's a cultural thing.
You know, that was the meaning I took from several chapters. And then this time around, like, fighting them kind of thing. So, you know, the change, the meaning of it had changed, but still laughing.
That's a great question. I got to look into it. I mean, because I don't actually know the answer to that.
But I also thought there was such comedic things, like with the two girls, right? And when she kissed her, and then she's like, ha ha, you thought I was really going to... I mean, it was like a soap opera. And even when the guy confesses, and then nobody believes him.
I think
it's the breadth of human emotion that he's depicting.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
But just that word just keeps popping up, and it just keeps rubbing me the wrong way, because it just doesn't seem to fit the circumstance.
Well, there's no better illustration of that than Lisa, right? Who's laughing inappropriately at inappropriate times.
Yeah.
So, Alyosha's future wife.
Well, is it this, like, is somebody speaks Russian, or like, I know somebody who speaks Russian, I'll have to ask them, like, is it just a bad translation or something?
Yeah, that's what, yeah, exactly. Something I'm missing here.
I go look at it. I have two different translations.
Yeah, that's a great
point. You can just see how the Bolshevik revolution was set up when you look at the history of reserves. Because they had a tremendous famine, too, and the Tsar was sitting here with all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And just see how this was. This on
the exactly. I mean, it's like Dostoevsky predicted the 20th. Yeah, right. You know, in one of Stalin's favorite books was The Brothers Karamazov.
That's kind of scary.
I know.
I never saw The Man of Steel as being one that I even read, honestly.
Oh, yeah, he was huge. He was a big literary man. Absolutely. He read a ton. Yeah. Yeah. He loved to read. But he loved The Brothers Karamazov, too. Yeah. I don't know if you've read Solzhenitsyn in the First Circle, but that's a great... What's that? Of course, yeah.
I like the fact in that book where he's talking about the fact that he's in the concentration camp, and then I think it was like 1938 or so, all the communists that were the true believers that are all in the concentration camp too with him.
Yeah.
One's like, you know, you put me in power, or you could take me out, so therefore I'm going to get rid of you, which I wish did the same thing, too.
Yeah.
Because it was really never about the economic system.
One of his favorite authors, Stalin's, was Bulgakov. So have you heard of the book, or movie, I could say, Master and Margarita? Well, they just made a movie, Master and Margarita, in Russia, and I really want to see it here, but the war with Ukraine has basically kept that from being able to be brought over here. I have a Russian version of it, but doesn't have English translation, so I don't really know what's said. But anyway, what's the point? One of his favorite plays is by Bulgakov. I just read it, and it is very good. Anyway, Bulgakov did not die of... He was not killed by Stalin, but he was unfortunately often suppressed by Stalin. And he actually died of kidney failure, but anyway. Master Margarita was a very controversial text. It would be a worthwhile. Are you kidding me?
Rita? You said you were reading the book. It's on the screen as we were looking.
Are you serious? Okay, I gotta look into that. Maybe it's out now.
I think there's a movie.
Huh. Yeah, there is a movie, but
you'll have time on the way to New Zealand.
I think so. What did you fly? Delta? It might not be on Delta anymore.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to look it up. Right. They have a ton. Okay, well, thank you, guys. We did a great job tonight, I think. Kept on task.
Yeah.
Oh, I hope I can watch it. I do want to do that.